You know who's got a mean risotto recipe? John Podesta.
I can only imagine
how I know this. It was hacked. Thanks to WikiLeaks, you too can make John Podesta's risotto.
He's right, though. The key is just to add the liquid very slowly.
Yeah, he got it. Was it so somebody he was emailing with said, I tried to make your risotto and it didn't work? And he was correcting them. Is this the idea?
Mm-hmm.
And you do have to add the liquid, I can attest, very slowly.
That should be a state secret. Now, the Russians.
Now the Russians know how to make good. How to break risotto. Down the starch and the rice bit by bit to make that creamy.
I have a message for John Podesta on risotto.
Yeah.
There's a two-factor authentication that you need. It's not enough to do the liquid. You also have to, you know, get from your phone the right code and use that. Because or else the Russians are in your risotto and they give it to Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah. He's going to eat a lot of it. Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the John Podesta Makes a Mean Risotto edition. I'm Shane Harris of The Daily Beast. I make a pretty damn good risotto, too.
Do you?
I'm just going to say for the record, yeah. And it takes time. You have to really perfect this.
And,
you have to practice
and
at it.
Podesta's advice.
Oh, yeah.
It's correct.
It's correct. You got to go bit by bit. You should actually toast the rice in the pan first, give it a certain nutty flavor. Some people like to use diced onions. If you're not a fan of onions, you don't have to. I recommend butter and also chicken stock, or if not, wine or both.
This is Shane's security strategy, right? He's saying everything he knows about risotto so no one will hack his emails.
That's right.
Just
there's
no point.
Putting
it out there.
Don't
no
waste
secrecy.
Your time. I'll tell you. Radical transparency.
Open book.
Yeah.
Please leave his email alone.
Please. No, seriously, please leave my email alone. Please. I've never done anything bad to you. Wait till you see my Halloween costume this year, by the way. I'm just not going to say anything else.
Is it going to be your object lesson?
It's going to be an object lesson.
Can we record with you in costume?
Sure.
Oh, all we right. should do a Halloween edition.
We will.
Okay.
I'm here with my friends.
What's Quinta going to dress up as?
I don't know. She's looking at us like, I don't want to dress up. You want to do it. Sure you do. Okay. As long as the levels are good. I'm here with my friends, Ben Wittes and Susan Hennessy. Hi, guys.
Hi, Shane.
We have a lot to get to on the podcast today. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton square off in their second presidential debate in St. Louis. And the intelligence community officially pins the blame on Russia for hacking U.S. political organizations. Plus, we're going to unpack a bunch of other hacking-related stuff this week, too. Why don't we start with...
Wait, can we just start with what we're not going to talk about?
What are we not going to talk about?
Because we are not going to talk about any women whom Donald Trump may have groped.
No.
You know, and that's not because it's not important. It's not because we are not as obsessed with this incredible story as everyone else is. We're all like furtively following it actively, but it's just beyond the scope of this podcast.
And also because we've lost count and we only have an hour here. So.
Yeah, it's not just one. It's actually now four or five or six.
I think CNN
so we're not ignoring the story. We're just ignoring the story. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. But be advised, we're aware. But let's talk about the debate. Obviously, the debate was happening against the backdrop of this the October surprise for Donald Trump, we might call it.
Surprises.
Surprises. They seem to keep coming, and I think the last shoe has not dropped. But why don't we just sort of like let's talk about some of the national security highlights. It was not specifically devoted to national security. It was a town hall format, but there were a number of things that are of interest to our audience that came up. The first, and I have to say, what was to me probably the most jaw-dropping moment, not just of the debate, but maybe even one of the most stunning moments of the campaign so far, was when Trump promised that if he is elected, he is going to direct his attorney general to appoint a special prosecutor to look into Hillary Clinton's email situation, as he put it, and then later said you should be in jail, or would be in jail, essentially, in a Trump administration. That's not how this works in our system. Susan, you're a lawyer. Would you like to start by talking about this?
I am a lawyer, although I will. I would refer people to a piece that Ben wrote sort of in response to this, entitled Grab Them by the Constitution, which I thought was pretty good. So there's sort of two reactions to that moment. One is just kind of the the interaction itself, right? That sort of aggressive bullying. I mean, sort of really the opposite of presidential, right? Just sort of a really jaw-dropping moment. And God, in a very low election cycle, maybe the lowest moment. Then there's sort of the substantive, I'm going to use my power, to jail political opponents. He's actually, since then, one comment he's made, kind of at rallies following up on that, is not only that he was going to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate Hillary Clinton, but he's also going to appoint a prosecutor to investigate the investigation, which I'm guessing is sort of a shot across the bow at Jim Comey, and whether or not he conspired to cover up a crime. This is jaw-dropping stuff. It's also something that Ben warned about, 2 months ago?
Yeah, I mean, I generally refrain from writing I told you so pieces, but I do think this one was something that the tone of the way he talked about political opponents, it was pretty easy to flag months ago that this was going to be a problem with Trump. And, I actually wrote a long piece about it. In response to that long piece, I started getting communications from people in the Justice Department, including one that, overtly asked for an ethics opinion about whether it was proper to continue serving under Trump. And I have been interested, actually, at how much of the anxiety on this score is from Republicans. After this incident at the debate, I tried to identify, given that there's no law on this stuff, you're actually sort of allowed to, if you look at the raw constitutional powers of the president, you actually can, go after political opponents. It's a,
Can you direct? I mean, so obviously there's malicious prosecution statutes. Is there any? I can't sort of bring to mind a legal prohibition on the president maliciously directing an investigation.
So I think you would run into ultimately an impeachment question about whether you were violating the take care that the laws be faithfully executed question. But I think there's but the protections against that are fundamentally normative and fundamentally political, not legal in character. And so in the day after the debate, I sat down and I wrote out sort of what I thought the three big norms that Trump had violated with this were. And by the way, he's done it before. This is not a new position on his part. So I thought, the first norm that he's violating is that we don't use the criminal enforcement powers of the federal government to go after people, after the president's political opponents. And that's, he just openly violated that. And the second one, and he did it proudly. There's always, in every administration, there's a, are they using the powers politically? But none of them say it.
He made it into a campaign ad
exactly.
The next day.
He has a campaign ad about it. So another one is that, the president doesn't direct the attorney general in specific law enforcement matters, and that we limit the contacts between the White House and federal law enforcement precisely as a sort of wall around the idea that justice is supposed to be independent and impartial. And then the third one is that, as the president of the United States, you're really not supposed to presume people's guilt. You're not supposed to say, you're guilty and I'm going to lock you up. What you're supposed to say is, a crime was committed and we're going to investigate who did it. And, when the Justice Department indicts somebody, they always, and journalists, they always use the, journalists always use the word allegedly until somebody's actually convicted. And that's a respect for process and a respect for the fact that people are innocent until proven guilty. And Trump really, you know, stomped on that. So I published this piece, and then within 12 hours or 15 hours of it, I get an email from Peter Keisler, who is, you know, a lawyer in town who used to run the civil division at the Justice Department and was briefly acting attorney general after, I think, after Alberto Gonzalez stepped down. And he's a, you know, very, very well-respected conservative lawyer in town. And he pointed out a fourth norm that I had not thought of at all, which I'll just read what he said. This wasn't an action by a sitting president, but a campaign promise to take such an action by a candidate. So on top of the fact that this would be a deeply improper action for any president to take, we also have the specter of someone running for office asking people to vote for him based on a promise to investigate and jail a particular person, having a national referendum over, in part, whether somebody should be prosecuted. One can debate whether it's better or worse to have prosecutorial decisions corrupted by the White House or by being subject to a popular vote, but worst of all is to have both. Hmm. And so, you know, I think it's pretty hard to overstate the magnitude of the violations of our expectations of the presidency and of the normal course of the justice system that this involves. And I will add that Susan is absolutely correct that in the period since I wrote these pieces, he has taken it to a different level by essentially impugning the integrity of all the FBI people who worked on the original investigation, including but not limited to the FBI director. And, you know, he's describing a corrupt system without any evidence of corruption of the system. And there's something, you know, deeply corrosive about
that. Well, and that's a preview, too, of, I think, what's going to happen in the general election, is it's the system was rigged, the establishment was out to get me, they're all in favor of Hillary Clinton, for which there will be no evidence, and that will not stop him at all. This is how he behaves.
Right. I mean, honestly, it's I've had sort of occasion to reread Learned Hand's The Spirit of Liberty speech, sort of
in
relation.
It's a spirit I hear of not being too certain that one is right.
Exactly. Actually sort of related in the intelligence community, context. You know, it's, like a refrain that sort of resonates, you know, the spirit of liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. You know, no, if it dies there, no court, no constitution can defend it. No court, no constitution could be much help. I'm probably butchering the precise quote. But that is, in some ways we're seeing just the most, incredible manifestation and bizarre perversion of that, in the sense that, Donald Trump, by making these statements, clearly does not hold these values within him. He does not believe in our Constitution. He does not believe in these principles. And that's a really scary thing, because ultimately that is the protection. And then at the same time, he's twisting that, by kind of, right, this is his projection, his counterpunching, by saying, no, it's all of you who are violating this, right? And so it's a perilous time. It's really some disturbing stuff.
Let's talk some more about some of the particular policy things that came up. He was pressed by the moderators on the Muslim ban. They read back his statement to him about Donald J. Trump is calling for a ban on all Muslims till we know what the hell is going on. Now he's changed it, of course, to extreme vetting.
Which is a good name for a band.
Very good name for a band. That's right. Let's talk a bit about this. I mean, what is the practical difference, you know, in terms of extreme vetting versus a ban? And also, they were both asked, both Clinton and Trump, by a Muslim American woman, you know, essentially, not explain yourselves, but I mean, more or less, like, you know, how am I supposed to receive what I'm hearing from both of you? And then they both talked about needing Muslim Americans to sort of be the eyes and the ears on the front lines, as Hillary Clinton put it. But Trump also had this extreme vetting component to it that seemed to immediately suspect all Muslims, or at least, as potential threats, including maybe even the ones who are already here, who he would also seemingly like to enlist in some kind of neighborhood watch.
So I actually thought, I mean, Donald Trump's response was certainly true to form, in the sense that this was really sort of a powerful moment of a Muslim American woman kind of looking at this man who said these terrible things and saying, you know, what do you say to me? And he said, you know, basically, Muslims are scary, right? We're right to be afraid. I thought Hillary Clinton had a real missed opportunity here, there was a misstep that I think would have been more significant, but for the sort of remarkable events of the past week in terms of the news cycle, and that's that she sort of endorsed this position that the primary reason to sort of extend civil liberties to Muslims or to have sort of to prevent Islamophobia from sort of taking root is so that Muslims will be law enforcement partners. This kind of weird reductive thing happens a lot, and it's even offered by people who I think are well intentioned and really are trying to sort of make the case, right? That this is why the NYPD Muslim surveillance was counterproductive, right? Because it's alienating a community, and really what you need is for those people to be looking. This is sort of saying, like, your primary value to us is spotters because your own community produces these people. Of course, every community of every description in the United States produces violent criminals. And those communities are always the front line, like, right? So, white supremacists, right? Very extreme, pro-life groups that are, advocating violence. Name the community, name the identity. That community is, capable of producing individuals that commit acts of violence, and that community is the primary sort of resource. And so I do wish that Hillary Clinton had taken a moment to sort of, acknowledge this woman's genuine question and not just say, well, we need to be nice to Muslims because we need you to tattle on people, on the bad Muslims, because there's the bad Muslims. And oh, by the way, we need to play nice with Muslim majority countries. But like, Islamophobia is wrong and it's sort of contrary to who we are.
So let me ask you something, Susan. So I had very much the same reaction. And I think the right answer to her question, which Hillary Clinton did not say, is, the question was really, what do you say to me as somebody who, you know, is negatively impacted by this presentation of, and the right answer is, we live in a society with religious freedom and where we evaluate individuals as individuals, full stop. And the question is, did she not go there because she doesn't have to? She's going to get nearly 100% of the Muslim vote anyway. And so she might as well talk about the issue that a lot of non-Muslims will think about when they hear that question. And therefore, at the risk of describing the Muslim community in a little bit of an instrumental fashion. Or is the reason that that's just kind of what she actually thinks the answer is? How strategic do you think this was?
I think that I actually think it's a little bit of both. I mean, on the one hand, she's clearly has to be somewhat sensitive to being accused of not calling it radical Islam and seeming weak on terrorism. And so maybe she wanted to use the sort of the front lines metaphor to bolster her credentials that way and say, look, I'm tough. But I imagine that she does feel pretty strongly that she wants Muslim Americans to be, informant might be too strong of a word, but this is consistently the line you hear coming out of the FBI and the Justice Department is, you know, we need people to sort of alert us to these things that are happening in their community. And it's in a way of saying there is an onus on you all as a quote unquote community to take some responsibility for this.
I sort of agree with that. I just think it's the secondary or tertiary answer to the question. And the primary answer to the question is we live in a liberal society.
Would have been nice if she led with that.
Exactly. I have no problem with saying I want everybody to cooperate with law enforcement and communities from which, you know, certain bad stuff generates, you know, may have particular, value or obligations to help. But there was a missed, Susan. I mean, I really agree with Susan. There was this missed moment where the answer to that woman's question is, you're a part of this community. That's the end of it.
Right. So I think, you know, sort of the instinct or sort of the strategic thing is that sort of there's one of kind of the campaign themes that has emerged is this notion that they're really actually central to national security or domestic homeland security issues, which is that we have to this sort of liberal denialism, right? This idea that this, you know, peace and love beatnik stuff is blinding us to really having sort of effective policy. We know something is going on. And so I think it's my gut is that the strategy is to not want to feed into that cycle of feeling like, oh, you know, liberals are sort of blinding themselves to this. I think at this point, though, because she is the presumptive president of the United States, this was an opportunity actually for her to lead, right? So not just to win, you know, some votes or reassure people, but to be confident enough to say, you know, I'm going to move us in a better direction, a more thoughtful direction, a safer direction.
Okay, let's move on to our next topic. Big news last week. It's official. Officially, Russia hacked U.S. political
organizations. It wasn't the 400-pound guy
definitely
on the bed.
Definitely not somewhere.
I just want to point out that I called for public attribution against Russia. And like
before it was cool.
And like 9 weeks later, the Obama administration, you know, answered. And that is influential results, guys.
Yeah. I mean, Brookings' slogan is quality, independence, and impact. And I want to say that that is an clearly an example
exactly.
of impact.
I mean, it's just there's a straight line from Susan Hennessy Lawfare. What do you know about the DNC hacks? The title of my piece. And then, you know, 2.5 months later, Obama saying what we know is Russians be hacking.
Be hacking. I'm going to read this section from the statement because I think there's something. There's actually a few things to unpack in here because I think that. The statement is more significant than it might seem just as a statement of, yes, we're blaming it on the Russians. The U.S. intelligence community is confident that the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from U.S. persons and institutions, including U.S. political organizations, the recent disclosures of alleged hacked emails on sites like DCLeaks.com and WikiLeaks and by the Guccifer 2.0 online persona are consistent with the methods and motivations of Russia-directed efforts. These thefts and enclosures are intended to interfere with the U.S. election process. Not often that you hear in a joint statement by intelligence and security officials, motivation is X. That's usually something that's pretty hard to judge. So in addition to being a fairly declarative statement, yes, the Russians did this, very closely positioning WikiLeaks over to being involved in this, but maybe they're just a receptacle, but also saying that the motivation was plainly to interfere with the election process. This is a pretty significant statement as I read it.
I think it's an incredibly significant statement. I think it's significant that it's a joint statement from both the intelligence community and Homeland Security. A lot of people don't realize, so obviously Homeland Security is involved because of election interference. There's also sort of separate and apart from kind of DHS's and PPD cyber teams, Homeland Security houses a lot of very, very consequential and effective investigative bodies. So the U.S. Secret Service, you know, different parts of immigration, you know, and customs, they all have significant roles in the investigation of cyber-enabled crimes. So I think that this is sort of this really is an all-in, right? This is kind of everybody who's really responsible for cyber in the government saying we think it's the Russians. The sort of the attribution aspect is interesting, right? They're being incredibly specific, not only about what they know, but about what they don't know, and being willing to speculate on motivation. I really do think is that's a real warning shot to the Russians, because it's really hard to know, right? To sort of glean why somebody might have done something. There are, of course, multiple reasons that people do things. You know, there's opportunistic stuff. There's mixed motivations, right? So I think that is sort of a little bit of a signaling of, potentially, we're listening to you. We know the conversations where we are confident enough to bring this to the public. So I think it's a little bit of a warning. I actually think the reason for this statement and sort of the Russian attribution part is a small paragraph at the beginning, and then all the rest is about the sort of electoral hacking of election systems and sort of the integrity of the election.
Which they tie to a Russian company, not the Russian government, but...
Right. I actually think that's the more significant thing. I think that's why the statement was issued.
It's sort of like a take this seriously, people in the States, and prepping the groundwork for, you know... Yeah, there is interference going on with the election, providing evidence of some kind, maybe.
Right. So essentially, I think the administration has known for months that the Russian government was behind the DNC hacks, right? The intelligence community came out and said they had high confidence, you know, as early as July. So the notion that, like, oh, some new piece of attribution information has come out where now they're really sure about the Russians, I think that they knew they had pretty much everything they needed to know very early on. The difference is the decision to make a public statement, right? They sort of seemed content to kind of, maybe it was a directed or strategic leak, but they didn't really, despite calls from Congress, Dianne Feinstein, Adam Schiff, and sort of public calls for them to, for the administration to really say what they knew, Obama had really indicated he wasn't going to get involved here. What changes is all of a sudden there's all this speculation about whether or not election systems are safe, right? Whenever we elect, you know, the president, are people going to believe that result? Honestly, I think the proliferation of those stories, and there was starting to be a little bit of an avalanche, right? So you had sort of initial reports of two, Arizona and I think Illinois is the other
Illinois
one.
Illinois and Arizona were the first two.
Then all of a sudden it's a dozen, then it's more than 20, right? This thing was starting to snowball and there was no information.
And variations of probing and actual access.
Right, but there wasn't, it was getting very confused happening. And I think paired with the campaign rhetoric of this is a rigged election, I think that the administration decided to take its case public because they want people to walk to on November 8th feel like they know who was actually elected president of the United States.
So I think there are a couple other factors. I agree with all that, but I think there are a couple other factors as well. One is that if you look at John Carlin's recent speeches, he's made clear that public attribution is something they're going to do when they can. And that, you know, that one of the significant features of and he talked about this on the Lawfare podcast, actually, that one of the significant features of the Chinese indictments was simply that they were able to say publicly who the individuals were, what computers they were using, and to attribute at that level of specificity publicly. And, you know, he's made clear that as a general matter, they want to be as public as they can about naming and shaming and indictments when they can do indictments. So that's one factor. I think in this case, the other aggravating factor is the ongoing activity of WikiLeaks and the, frankly, weird relationship between WikiLeaks and the Republican nominee for president, who is now openly endorsing WikiLeaks, talking, you know, he shouted, "I love WikiLeaks" at his Wilkes-Barre, rally the other day. And there's a huge New York Times story on the front page this morning about the relationship between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks. And so I think when you're, and Roger Stone, the Trump advisor, boasted yesterday, I believe, that he had met with the WikiLeaks people in the run-up to this latest round of disclosures.
He's talked about that before, too.
And so when you put together the belief of the intelligence community that you're dealing with a state actor, you know, the Russian state actor, and you're dealing as well with a non-state actor, i.e. WikiLeaks, that the only debate in the intelligence community, as a certain Shane Harris reported this week in the Daily Beast, the only real debate in the intelligence community is whether WikiLeaks are useful idiots on behalf of Russian intelligence or active agents on the part of Russian intelligence. So you have the state actor that did the hack, the non-state actor that are understood as either intentional or unintentional fronts for the state actor. And then you have the U.S. national political candidate of a major party who is actively embracing and slipstreaming behind the activity of that non-state actor. That is a very weird constellation of factors that militates very strongly, I think, for being clear about who these actors are, and that when Trump gets in bed with these people, he's getting in bed with Russian intelligence.
Right. So actually, I've been thinking a lot about sort of the WikiLeaks connection, not just obviously because of the news cycle, but also based on a tweet that the Grug Q, which is a great.
How do you pronounce him?
I don't know.
Is it Grug?
Scott, I always think Gruck when I see it.
Okay.
He's very, I want to say I love his Twitter picture.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful image. He's a good-looking guy, if that's him.
If that's him. Terrible operational security if he decided to use his real picture. But yeah,
it's a really good Twitter feed, and you should all follow it.
Yes, and he has really interesting observations, and he sort of he mentioned the notion of actually a really important part of cyber-enabled information warfare is having a credible distribution platform. That if you don't have a way to credibly sort of put information into the public, it's really hard to achieve these kinds of operations. And WikiLeaks has, served this really, really interesting role, actually. And I do think it's sort of, I think you're right that like, that this, the relationship between WikiLeaks and the Russians is incredibly important, because it should be the lens through which we view every piece of information that is emerging, right? So one, there's clear evidence that there's forgeries among the Podesta email drop, right? Sort of, I mean, amateurish stuff of just clearly fake emails that were inserted. Two, and I'll sort of kick this over to Shane as kind of a broader question of national security reporting in the age of mass leaks. And that's okay. If reasonable people understand the relationship between WikiLeaks and Russian intelligence, and at least some real information is included, and it's obviously being leaked for a reason, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong, and there's certainly newsworthy information, how should you be thinking about covering that material?
Well, this question actually, I think, was also put forward pretty forcefully by the Clinton campaign spokesperson, Brian Fallon, who said, you know, to journalists who are writing about this stuff, why don't you also remind people that this is private stolen information that was provided, you know, by the Russian government to WikiLeaks? To your first point question, I mean, how do we think about covering? I mean, I worry less in a way about sort of the provenance of the information, because information comes to us as journalists from all kinds of paths, and it's, you know, frequently stolen information, and we're the recipients of that. What troubles me in this case is being able to tell what is real and what is not. And are we in?
Is the risotto recipe real?
God, I hope so. It seems like a really good recipe.
If I were Russian intelligence, forging John Podesta's risotto recipe would be
like 1 cup parmesan, 1 tablespoon just plutonium.
Think how many Democrats terrible. You could kill by if you just got mm-hmm. I'm just saying that, and you'd be, your hands would be on none of it.
Mm-hmm. Democrats love risotto. Mm-hmm. But no, I worry about in the first instance, I worry about is what I'm reporting on actually real information, or am I being set up to write something that's misleading or just false? But I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm being not giving enough consideration to the provenance issue. But for me, it's like, look, it's out there, and we can report on it responsibly. That's the key thing. But I mean, are you asking, like, do you think we should refrain from reporting on it because They were hacked emails?
So this was actually my point sort of in the – in whenever I wrote about this originally, right, and sort of the need for attribution. And I think one of the most important reasons why the U.S. government should go on record early is to give the press a sort of a reference point for giving really credible context. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that this is – and sort of the WikiLeaks DC leaks thing is a pretty good example of that. There was a lot of early speculation about Russian involvement as sort of more information came to the public about what the intelligence community believed. And the press was really presenting this information as, you know, Russians have hacked this information and this is what it says. And it was highly contextualized. As the administration failed to say anything and as sort of time passed and more information kept coming out, that context started to go away, right? That there was not every single article referenced the potential provenance. And I think that that's dangerous. I think that it really is important that if you're going to report on this stuff, to situate it in the appropriate context.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. Like saying this was dropped in the midst of a series of hacks that the intelligence community believes are being done for political manipulation. Yeah, that's fair.
So I think the issue is a little bit more complicated than that. So I would never argue that there is an exclusionary rule that we should not consider information that was obtained by illicit means.
We wouldn't have much to report on.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of stuff is stolen. A lot of stuff that's leaked is actually formally stolen. The Trump tax returns were certainly presumptively not given by somebody who was entitled to, unless it was in fact Marla Maples, right?
I'm totally on this.
Totally Marla Maples.
But you can't, the point is you can't assume, but that it was proper for somebody to give that. On the other hand, I do think when you know that there is a foreign intelligence operation ongoing to interfere with your country's electoral system, and what your role that they've imagined in that electoral, in that operation is as a journalist, they're going to dump this stuff and you're going to write about it. It does seem to me that there is a little bit of a burden to think about what role you want to play in Russian intelligence's efforts to affect the U.S. electoral system. And that is a different question. I think you should always ask yourself that question. How is my source trying to manipulate me? What am I? But I do think that's a different question than, you know, what is Edward Snowden trying to do here, or what is the individual who I don't even know who sent this tax return to the New York Times trying to do? I do think in the presence of a, you know, public attribution or a non-public attribution, that there's a foreign actor, you know, engaged in a systematic effort to corrupt the electoral system, you do as a reporter have to sit there and spend at least a little bit of time saying, what role do I or don't I want to play?
Right. And one notable point on the Podesta emails is that they were dropped 30 minutes after the initial report of the Access Hollywood video of Trump making, you know, obscene comments about sexual assault.
Which actually was strategically pretty dumb, I think.
Yeah, because it caused them to get no coverage.
Right.
But I do think it's unfair to presume it was reactionary. You think it was coincidental?
Oh, I thought you were saying it was. I thought you were implying it was reactionary.
Oh no, I'm saying I think it is reactionary. Yeah, I'm saying it's strategically bad.
If it is reactionary, it was strategically not wise timing.
Yeah, I agree. Although I don't. Again, this is also why I have some sort of suspicions about what the Russians are really doing here.
I'm not sure the Russians even know what the Russians are doing.
This is what I think. One, I think they got lucky, right? This idea that the sort of targeted thing, you push up against lots of things, you get lucky, things pay off. Mm-hmm. You know,
chaos
maybe,
Muppets.
Right, they're total chaos Muppets. The other thing is like the idea that anybody could actually predict what is going to sort of take hold of the news cycle, what's useful, how sort of this complex American body politic is going to react. I think the Russians love the idea. They love the narrative that sort of, oh, they're the puppet masters of the world and they can, you know, shift the U.S. elections. I don't think anybody could actually strategically deploy this stuff, let alone sort of, I just don't think their intelligence about the United States is really that sophisticated.
Well, I think, well, to that point, I think that's actually, I was actually talking with my friend Julia Yaffe recently about this, who's a terrific Russia reporter, and was making the point that it's really only seems like in recent years that Russia has gotten even marginally more sophisticated about understanding our political system, and that really it is like Vladimir Putin views it like House of Cards, that he sees it in this very sort of, you know, Machiavellian dramatic kind of context and doesn't get how really diffused our system is and how complicated
and dysfunctional.
He thinks that everything in our system is as Machiavellian as he is.
Right, exactly.
I mean, he's projecting his own behavior and working assumptions about Russia onto the American political system.
But we got a great example this week too of how this can all backfire. So Donald Trump, I think it was in the Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania rally, says, let me read you something that just came out of these emails from WikiLeaks. Sidney Blumenthal. And of course, everyone goes, boo. Never mind that like 90% of the audience couldn't tell you who Sidney Blumenthal actually was. He's just bad and he's with Hillary Clinton. Starts reading off this, you know, list of indictments about Hillary and Benghazi and saying this came out from the Podesta email leaks, and that Sidney Blumenthal writes that if Republicans want to use Hillary Clinton, I'm paraphrasing, negligence over security in Benghazi as a talking point to go after her, that is legitimate. Well, what he failed to realize is that this information actually wasn't from Sidney Blumenthal. It was from a long 10,000-word Newsweek magazine piece by Kurt Eichenwald, and he was quoting from one small section in it, and it was an email that Blumenthal had sent around to people in the campaign, quoting liberally from the article. This email then got picked up by Sputnik News, which is a Russian propaganda outfit, reported as Sidney Blumenthal said all these things. Donald Trump then reads it as Sidney Blumenthal said all these things, raising the question of whether this active measures campaign by the Russians, which is meant to sow disinformation, actually did and then got picked up by Sputnik and then somehow fed to Donald Trump via his campaign aides, who then repeated this thing that is actually not true and now has been outed as such.
I mean, it raises the question that I, you know, raised again, which is, you know, how should we think about the soup that is the combination of Russian intelligence, the Trump campaign, and WikiLeaks? And, you know, who's driving what train here? And this incident, which Kurt Eichenwald, and people should read the article, it's really stunning. This incident shows, I think, pretty vividly that the Trump campaign is not distinguishing between material on WikiLeaks and Russian front spin on that stuff. And they're just gobbling it all up. And it really does raise the question, what is the relationship between the Trump campaign and the Russian intelligence apparatus?
So I think this is a great example of the useful idiot. I think that Trump has a inept amateur staff. I think that they follow all of these various news outlets, frankly, because they are lazy. There's lots of talking points that pop up. They've found these sort of Twitter troll armies to be effective. They have a media wing that is not being critical, right? So sort of the Breitbart, if we're going to call that media, that is happy to sort of pick this stuff up. And the real shift is that opponents in the United, you know, U.S. political opponents in the past would not have just taken up a Russian talking point, even if it was helpful, right? Because they would have been smart enough to know it would backfire. And two, because that's right, they have their own concerns about Russia. They don't want to get played. They don't want Russians to be influencing the United States. Here, I think what you really see is this kind of when you have this this warming, when you have this willingness to consume the material, you know, on top of frankly amateurs in the field, you end up with a presidential nominee that is a mouthpiece sort of directly passing on, you know, Russian propaganda to the U.S. people. It's really scary in an election. The idea of the president of the United States doing that is catastrophic.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you that we're dealing in useful idiot department, not in active agent. Although, you know, where the Paul Manafort's of the world fall into that may be complicated. But that said, I think the idea of the president of the United States as a useful idiot is really unattractive.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to object lessons. Susan, you want to go first?
Sure. I have a brief object lesson. It's a field trip that Ben and I took recently to replace our driver's licenses.
Did you get the new real ID?
We did, right. So I lost my driver's license. Ben, I think yours just had expired.
My driver's license did yeoman service, but now 8 years later, it needed to be replaced.
So we decided to take a lawfare field trip to go to the DMV, to replace our licenses. As we were walking in, Ben cursed me by saying, "I wonder which one of us will not have the right documents and have to leave."
Because I was following a long held rule of DMV attendance, which is that you never go to the DMV and deal with your issue and then leave. You go to the DMV and there's some deficiency and then you have to leave and come back.
Mm. Right. So, the weak link in our expedition was sadly me. I would have put good money on it being Ben, but it ended up being me. So the real ID is like the new statutory, it's a new statute basically that your identity has to be verified again, right? So in the past, you could just reorder a replacement license online. Now you have to go and provide all this documentation. So I'm giving them all the documents, right? So I give my birth certificate and my passport and my social security card. And then I produce tax documents, right, that have my name I have to prove where I live. I prove my address. So I have a tax document, you know, has both mine and my husband's name on it with the address. You know, we share the same last name. Then I produce gas bills, right, electric bills that you have to have two separate pieces of proof of residency.
I didn't have to prove this much to get my mortgage.
This was literally less onerous.
The Real ID Act, man.
Scrubbed.
So I offered this electric bill, or gas bill or whatever it was. Apparently it's in the 1950s because it has my husband's name on it. Frankly, because I don't like dealing with that stuff and he's a more organized human being. No, that's not going to work. So I show these people not only that I have tax documents with my name and address, I also have my marriage license proving that I am married to the person. We have the same last name and we share tax documentations that show that we own the property in question. No. Not acceptable. That is not sufficient to meet the real ID standards. It's not going to be safe. So I'm looking at this man and I'm sort of having that moment where I'm like, do I have a sit-in right now? Do I just look at this man and say, like, I'm not leaving until you give me a driver's license? When he tells me that I can either, have my husband verify, my residency by signing a form, which I'm sorry. Hell no. On principle, I'm not doing. Or I could email him a document. Something with my name on it. So I stand there, I have my cell phone and I call my husband and I say, do you have our mortgage stuff anywhere in your email? So he pulls up a mortgage statement and he emails it to this gentleman at the DMV. This person at the DMV doesn't know him from Adam, right? It's a random email address that has a PDF attachment that purports to be a mortgage statement with my name on it, right? Could have come from anywhere. Excellent. Prints it out, accepts it, no problem. So I lamented afterwards that while I understand the objectives of the real ID, what meaningful security or identity verification aim came from the sort of insane bureaucratic rules that will not allow the electric bill, but will allow just some dude sending an email.
Wow.
So here's the big question. When Susan Hennessy presents you her real ID in the future, should you assume that this is a terrorist plot and that this is not really Susan? Or should you assume that it's the real ID is real good enough ID?
Plot.
Totally plot. Nonsense. Is it security theater? I don't even know
That's
what it
amazing.
Is.
That's amazing. Also, you're giving me like 15 reasons to put off this, doing this as long as possible.
Just read the instructions about what documents you have to bring carefully. Oh. For
I
me, the process
note,
was pretty painless.
I will also note that when I lost my driver's license, it was while I was traveling, and I learned at Logan Airport that in a pinch, you can use a prescription bottle and a clip from PBS NewsHour with your name on it to get through TSA security.
At
so
Logan.
At Logan Airport.
For those,
know,
for those, for those of you, who,
went through once.
For those oh of you God. Who do not have a clip of yourself on the PBS NewsHour, go with the pill bottle.
You totally just wanted to drop that.
Yeah, yeah.
Ben, what's your object lesson?
So for the last few weeks, since, to be precise, early September, September 3rd, I have been engaged in an experiment, which is to see whether I can do as good an electoral forecast as the 538 folks with, you know, less than 1% of the effort. And, you know, there's a semi-serious point, actually a genuinely serious point here, which is that, you know, I follow the 538 site pretty religiously. I listen to their podcast. I think very highly of them. And I think there's a bunch of really good analysts there. But I also think that they, have this thing, which they call their model, which they talk about with almost reverential respect. And by all accounts, the model is a very complicated piece of computer software with many thousands of lines of code and a huge amount of data input into it. And so my question is, could you replicate the essential functionality of that model with a tiny, tiny fraction of the effort? And so what I did is I built a very simple spreadsheet. It's two pages of spreadsheet. One which is a polls only model like the 538 one that doesn't involve any interpretive, device on my part at all. And the other which involves a little bit of my own instincts. And I tried to create a very simple model actually based on the way my mom, who's a mathematical statistician, had told me many years ago how to estimate the number of people who were coming to my wedding. For the last month and a half, I've been, you know, updating this thing every day, every other day. And the amazing thing is it has tracked the 538 model incredibly precisely, though it has no data in common with the 538 model.
This is Ben's way of saying he thinks that 538 is 83.67% full of shit.
Well, so I think
I would like to challenge him to a Taekwondo match.
No. This is not a challenge to 538. I have a lot of respect for 538. But the question is, what's the marginal value of all this extra work they're doing? And I think, we will see who is closer to, the actual electoral count vote on election day. My guess is, so far our models have been so similar in their output that it'll actually be hard, may actually be hard to tell who's outperformed whom. But the question that it raises to me really is, are these electoral forecast people, including the New York Times, which has one, you know, on their front page every day, including the Princeton people, you know, are they overinvesting in, and, you know, creating these very data heavy, very code heavy models that are actually not adding a huge amount of value to what you can do with a good head on your shoulders, an Excel spreadsheet and a and you know, reading the polls every day. And so I, you know, I'll link to it on the show page today. And people should look at my it contains a methodological statement, and it, unlike the 538 forecast, it is entirely public. There is no secret data. There's no it's completely transparent. And so I'm interested in people's reactions. You can tweet them at the show. You can tweet them at me. Does this give you what 538 is giving without a whole lot of, faux precision and pretense at scientific and mathematical rigor?
Nate Silver is going to come for you.
I'm
84% certain.
People love whenever you say, I could do your job with like 2%.
I mean, to be,
and he might be true.
To be fair to Nate Silver, the 538 model does do things that this model doesn't do, like give a percent chance that Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump is going to win. I don't do that. All I'm trying to do is predict the electoral vote outcome.
All right.
We're going to find out. But I would love to have a discussion with them on their podcast or invite them on Rational Security. Not that it's sort of beyond the scope of this podcast, but I'd love to go chat with them about it and to sort of to figure out how their model, in fact, differs from this and whether this is just a really very simple example of what, in fact, they have made very complicated.
To be continued.
A poll off.
Meet me in the poll.
Prediction off.
Meet me in the playground at noon.
No,
I don't think you should
like,
say that as a
I'm not challenging them to a fight. I'm just saying, what's the marginal value of all this work they're doing?
We're a warrior culture at Rational Security. And if it's not challenging someone to a fight, I can't stand for it.
Unless somebody bleeds.
I think Susan is challenging Harry Enten to a fight right now.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Come on. Look at these guns. I can do it for sure.
Oh, dear. Well, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find our show archive at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. And when you download the podcast from Stitcher or iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, please remember to leave a rating and review. That helps us out a lot, and we really appreciate it. Our audio engineer is Quinta Jurassic. The show producer and editor is Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by Donald Trump and Extreme Vetting.
Excellent.
That makes you happy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, you're smiling.
Because Extreme Vetting, somebody's got to use it as a band name.
Sophia Yan, who actually performs our music, would totally be like the lead singer in a metal band called Extreme Vetting. Can't you see that?
Yeah.
And they'd have like really just like sick keyboards.
But back particularly back when she had her nose ring.
Yeah, she could totally pull that off, man. Yeah. Be awesome. All right. On behalf of my friends Ben Wittes and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris, and we're going to talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.